It's time to register to vote for the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Each congregation or multi-point parish must register their pastor and lay voters with the LCMS Office of Secretary by Sunday, March 24th of 2019. A nomination form has been mailed to every LCMS congregation. Learn more at issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident. issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident. I first started hearing the term when I was an official employee of a church body about 20 years ago, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The term, odd to hear, kind of floating around in breathless tones, policy-based governance. At the time, I had no idea what people were talking about, but it was all the rage. It was going to make the church more efficient. It was going to allow the church to be more nimble and responsive at least at the denominational level. It was going to save money. That was the big thing that we often heard about policy-based governance. But I also, after a time, started to feel the impact of policy-based governance. There was a bottleneck, a wall between me as a staffer and people that I would hope to be able to communicate with, the boards, the program boards that were overseeing the kind of work that I did in radio for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And I wonder how good a fit policy-based governance has proved to be in the church. It's been a good fit for a lot of businesses and other organizations, but what about the church? The church has prior commitments that means that both the boards and the people who work for them and all the programs that are run at a national level, they don't just answer to efficiency and to whether or not the bottom line is being met. They answer to the Word of God. And in our case, as Lutherans, the Lutheran Confessions. We're going to be talking about policy-based governance in the church. Dr. Ken Sherb joins us. He has a PhD in church history from Ohio State University. He's Director of Evangelism and Missions, Stewardship and Human Care for the Central Illinois District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, welcome back.
Hey, Todd. Delighted to be with you today.
What is policy-based governance?
Well, at best, policy-based governance is an approach to the work of a governing board, and that's an important term here that I think we'll unpack later, a governing board, so that that board can make an impact on its organization, and really it's designed, finally, to make the organization more accountable to the owners of the organization. And as I say, this is a kind of a philosophy or an approach to governance that is appropriate for governing boards, not the subsidiary boards down the line. And it's not necessarily a Christian thing or even a religious thing. Policy-based governance really arose in secular circles, and it is applicable to a wide variety of various subject areas. A lot of policy-based governance had the impetus behind it of trying to keep boards from getting into the weeds, broadening and heightening their vision so that they were focused more on policies than individual practices or even individual decisions. Everybody probably has been to some kind of a meeting, whether at church or the garden club or whatever, where they spent a half hour trying to figure out what color to paint a wall or what kind of equipment to buy or something like that. And policy-based governance is trying to set the focus on policies so as to avoid those kinds of things. I might add, by the way, that even though the word policy comes in that term, policy-based governance, obviously this is not the only form of governance that uses policies. There were policies in place in a lot of places, whether secular or religious, long before there was something called policy-based governance, it's 25 years ago or so. Policy-based governance, another characteristic of it is that it makes real clear and abiding distinctions between ends and means. And that's one of the ways of trying to keep you from getting into the weeds and micromanaging. Another characteristic of policy-based governance is, very broadly speaking, to give plenty of authority to whatever executive you've got. Now, policy-based governance does not necessarily require that you have somebody who is designated as the chief executive officer or something like that. You can do policy-based governance if you don't have that one focal person. But most boards that try to use it do have somebody like that. And they basically tell him, okay, here are the things that you are not supposed to do. We kind of set the fences for you. And everything within those limits, within those fences that you do, well, that's all okay. So it's a kind of a, you know, to use the buzzword, it's an empowering sort of thing for the executive. And very often you can kind of spot policies that are in policy-based governance form from the way they are stated, because they will say things like, the executive shall not fail to whatever, you know, the executive shall not fail to balance the budget or to bring the board a balanced budget to approve or something like that. Now, even the policy-based governance people these days say that that way of stating things always in the negative is kind of outdated. But you show me somebody who's got policies that are stated in that form, and I'll show you somebody who has had some policy-based governance consultant or something like that has gone over their policies. And one of the things that we used to joke about when I was working for the Synod 20 years ago is that if the executive violates one of your policies, what's the first thing you do? Well, you review the policy. You ask, is there anything wrong with our policy, rather than asking, did the executive actually do something wrong?
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest when we come back. What is the allure, especially for the church, in policy-based governance?
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California. Zion Lutheran, Muscoda, Illinois. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dubuque, Iowa. Trinity Lutheran, Paola, Kansas. St. Paul Lutheran of Good Harbor, Cedar, Michigan. Trinity Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas. St. John Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania. Mount Calvary Lutheran, Brookings, South Dakota. And Emmanuel Lutheran, Manchester, New Hampshire. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday afternoon, March the 7th, we're talking with Dr. Ken Sherb about policy-based governance in the church. Ken, how would you describe the attraction or the allure of policy-based governance, especially for national-level church bodies?
Well, I think I stated a couple of them just in the last few minutes. We do, especially, I think, in the church, have a tendency to micromanage a lot. And, you know, you didn't need policy-based governance to come along and tell you, hey, that's a bad idea. Don't micromanage. But that's a big theme in policy-based governance, and I think it's a reason why it becomes attractive to people. It gets you away from needless and really, in many ways, counterproductive micromanagement. What it hopefully does is to promote efficiency and enable an organization to respond quickly, because you have given the executive a great deal of authority. You don't have to wait for the next meeting even for him to do something. As long as he's working within those parameters you've set out, the executive can go ahead and do something immediately, potentially. Decisions, hopefully, in policy-based governance are made a lot closer to where they are supposed to be implemented. And again, that's one way of keeping the board out of the weeds and not having to go over all the minutiae in every board meeting. Perhaps policy-based governance gives you clearer lines of authority. It is designed to do that. Whether it actually does that, I have my doubts at times. It's supposed to help clarify that a governing board is not supposed to be for the management, for the staff of an organization, simply a consultant, nor an adversary, or window dressing for the management, for the executive. And those are great goals if they work. Again, sometimes they don't necessarily work, but that is a laudable kind of goal. I think of a lot of the allure of policy-based governance, especially 20 years ago or so when I was really dealing with these matters a lot. The allure of policy-based governance in the 90s, Todd, seems to me to have been a lot like the allure of church growth programs and, you know, sort of kits that you would get for congregations when they came out in the 80s. A lot of people went for that church growth stuff, not because they had any deep philosophical or theological commitments along the lines of the church growth people who produced them. It's just that this was a relatively easy to understand, and you could implement it kind of step by step, one, two, three, and it helped you to get organized. I'm thinking of one congregation that I was familiar with in Ohio. They thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread, their church growth stuff, because it helped them to be organized in a way that they had never been organized before. Well, again, policy-based governance has that same kind, or at least did have that same kind of attraction to people. You didn't need policy-based governance to come along and tell you don't micromanage. But when they come along and tell you don't micromanage and give you some alternatives that can help you to keep from micromanaging, that proves to be pretty attractive and hard to resist. Now, there's one other thing that I think we do need to take cognizance of. In a sinful world, if you're a board member and you're operating with policy-based governance, it's very tempting to think that now all of a sudden you can have your cake and eat it too, because you're no longer dealing with these micromanaged things. You're no longer having to really spend a lot of time on the minutiae of your organization. But the downside of that is that sometimes board members can think, well, that means I don't really have to think all that much about the organization at all. And, you know, I can just come to a board meeting, hear a few reports, and then go home and at times be recognized in the public because I'm a member of the board of this, the organization or that, and that's kind of nice, but it's really no longer as much work to be on the board of some organization. As I say, that's not exactly a wonderful kind of motivation, but I do think it has a place that we have to consider here.
When did the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod begin to employ policy-based governance, especially at the national board level?
Well, I don't know that the synod itself ever sat down and said, we're going to do policy-based governance. There are some national level boards. I was aware of some of the program boards, for example, of the synod, doing flirtations to one degree or another with policy-based governance in the 1990s when I was working for the synod. And they very often wanted to do that because they had been micromanaging and they knew they had to get out of that kind of a downward spiral. And so how do you do it? And here were some people who gave you some ideas about how to do it. Also, there tended to be, they're due in organizations like the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the people who rise to be the executives of boards, executives of whole areas, whole agencies of the synod, tend to be kind of strong personalities and strong leaders. And when you have reticent board members and or board members who are thinking, hey, this is pretty good, now I don't have to do so much work and be a board member, and at the same time, very strong executives. Again, in a sinful world, that can be a bad combination.
I'm curious about that, Ken, as just an aside. Is policy-based governance pervasive enough in the way it changes the functioning of a board and an institution, various agencies of a church body, given the polity of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? Would it have been a good idea for the synod to be allowed to decide whether or not policy-based governance was a direction that it wanted its national boards to go? In other words, should this been made a question for the entire synod to answer in convention.
That's an interesting point, Todd. And, you know, I think you're the first person I've ever even talked to who raised it, even retrospectively. You know, did we kind of miss an opportunity here? Yeah, it could be that we missed an opportunity to have a kind of a study, to have a kind of a, you know, reasoned consideration of this thing before people started jumping in the pool.
Okay, then why did you become interested in the application of policy-based governance in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod?
Well, because I saw people jumping in the pool. Now, I got to tell you, Todd, I am not talking here about congregations. There are congregations that have tried to implement policy-based governance as part of their own governance structure. What I saw sitting at synodical headquarters 25 and more years ago was agencies of the synod, various program boards, educational institutions, synod-wide corporate entities, etc. And see, I used to read the agendas of a lot of these boards for the president of the synod to make him aware of what they were doing and what kinds of things he might need to monitor, or the kinds of things he might need to tell them. I had conversations with board members who talked about the frustrations they were having with policy-based governance models as they were attempting implementation at the time. And I got particularly concerned that in a model that does tend to emphasize efficiency, at least as it's commonly implemented, it was very difficult at times to get theological concerns to the floor in some board meetings. And of course, that's always a prime consideration in the church when theology is kind of taking a back seat, whether that's a studied choice to put it back there or just kind of an unintended consequence. Either way, that's got to be something that raises a red or at least a yellow flag. The other thing that I saw was that board members and boards in general were spending a lot of time just sort of monitoring themselves, making sure that their policy manuals were in apple pie order and all that kind of stuff. And now you would think that now that they got the policy manual all set, they can really start working on governing the agency. But they'd sort of like start painting the Golden Gate Bridge all over again, and they'd go back to refining the policies of that particular board all over. So what I ended up doing, one of my colleagues, Al Borcherding, urged me to write just a white paper, a kind of a study on this. What I managed to squeak out was more a set of theses. And I wanted to make it brief. I didn't want it to make to be daunting. I didn't want people to look at this thing and say, oh, gosh, one more thing for me to read. I'll never get through this. So I really tried to get my set of theses and antitheses down to about 3 pages. And I was hoping that this would be a basis for discussion. And I circulated it around to various people. Well, the one thing that my set of theses had in common with Luther's 95 theses of 1517 was that he didn't get the discussion he was looking for. And I didn't get one really either, except with particular individuals on specific points, not the whole document. But one of the first things that I said in that document is that the prime criterion for evaluating some governance approach or philosophy for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I would think for any church, is its capacity to advance faithfulness to the Lord, faithfulness to the gospel, faithfulness in our case to Scripture and the Lutheran confessions, and also its ability to recognize the role of certain procedures that have been developed over the years in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to aid the cause of faithfulness to Scriptures and the confessions. Let me give you a neutral example of what I'm talking about here, one that has nothing to do with this policy-based governance talk. But one of the things that the synod used to maintain for just years and years and years was, if you are going to be a Missouri Synod congregation, you must have a Missouri Synod pastor. Now, was that absolutely theologically required or warranted? No, because Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recognizes many church bodies with which it is in fellowship around the world, and recognize that those pastors teach the gospel and administer the sacraments truly and rightly according to Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. In principle, you could have somebody be a pastor of a Missouri Synod congregation who was actually a member of some other church body that with which we were in fellowship. That would present no theological problem. But for years, the Synod said, nope. If it's going to be a Missouri Synod congregation, then that congregation is going to have a Missouri Synod pastor because it just makes it that much cleaner, that much better by way of keeping everybody on the same page, faithful to Scripture and the confessions. I might add that that requirement has loosened up a little bit here recently, and there is now more allowance of having Missouri Synod congregations served by pastors of other church bodies. But even then, that's only in certain particular cases. Another example of a procedure that kind of grew up, or a practice that kind of grew up over the years in the Missouri Synod that helped to advance faithfulness to Scripture and the confessions, and that I think a governance model needs to be at least cognizant of and respectful of, and that has changed very greatly, is the idea of having the congregations of the Synod meet in convention with boards that were directly responsible to that convention, to those congregations as they were gathered, as their representatives were gathered in that convention. That too used to be a just fundamental thing that we thought of as very important to helping us maintain our faithfulness. Anyway, the overall point that I'm trying to make here, Todd, is that it's faithfulness that ought to commend a governance philosophy, not its capacity for efficiency. And as soon as we start looking to something like efficiency as the thing that would commend an approach, we're looking in the wrong place and we're barking up the wrong tree.
Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We're talking about policy-based governance in the church. When we come back, he has two concerns and we'll find out what they are. Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Matt Harrison, is the author of our Book of the Month for March, Why Am I Joyfully Lutheran? Instruction, Meditation, and Prayers on Luther's Small Catechism. This new devotional resource is available in print and as an ebook. Learn more about Why Am I Joyfully Lutheran at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 and request the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. Why am I joyfully Lutheran?
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're talking about policy-based governance in the church. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Here's a little bit from the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March called Why Am I Joyfully Lutheran? from Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He says, we can go back to the place in modern Jerusalem where the events of Christ's cross happened, but we have no command in the Bible to do so, nor any promises that in doing so we would find forgiveness. The Creed proceeds to direct us to the place where the benefits of the cross are delivered today. Those benefits are found in the Holy Christian Church and the communion of saints. Some meditations, some thoughts, and some instruction on the third article of the Apostles' Creed from the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for March. Why Am I Joyfully Lutheran? Instruction, Meditation, and Prayers on Luther's Small Catechism by Pastor Matt Harrison. You can find it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for March. Why Am I Joyfully Lutheran? Available in both print and an ebook. 1-800-325-3040. Can you say that you have two concerns about policy-based governance in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod? What are they?
Well, not surprisingly, maybe, whenever somebody comes up with a new idea, particularly one that's got a lot of subtlety to it, and policy-based governance has a lot of subtlety to it, the two big issues were misunderstanding and misapplication.
Then, regarding the first, how in particular has policy-based governance been misunderstood in the LCMS?
Well, it's been misunderstood in a lot of places. John Carver, who probably even still today is kind of noted to be the guru of policy-based governance, he's not the only thinker in the field, but he's probably the leading one. Even 20 years ago and more, he was constantly having to remind people what this thing was and what it was not. For example, Carver said that you don't have to relinquish all control over means and solely concentrate on ends if you are a governing board operating under policy-based governance. But there were governing boards, apparently, not only in the church, but elsewhere, who said, oh, we're policy-based governance, therefore we're not concerned with means at all. Carver said, no, you got me wrong. Let me explain this to you again. Or another clarification that Carver was making over 20 years ago, the board does not have to restrict itself to deciding only the very broadest of issues. I mean, you don't have to kind of fall off the horse on the other side in your eagerness to get away from micromanaging and now get to the point where you're not hardly getting to any kind of specifics at all. And again, you're confining yourself only to the broadest of issues. Carver himself was saying to people, that's not policy-based governance. Now, that's, again, over 20 years ago. What I've just been quoting, it came out in one of his newsletters, I think, from 1998. Over two decades later, I hope there's greater clarity about what policy-based governance is and is not, if only because Carver and others learned just how to say it better, how to say it more clearly so that people would understand.
Regarding your second concern, misapplication, how in particular has policy-based governance been misapplied in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod?
Yeah, this is the concern about trying to put a square peg in a round hole, that you would try to make something fit in a church body with a particular theology, a particular governance legacy, a particular set of priorities. And the danger then is that you change the organization itself, that policy-based governance, in effect, no longer is the servant, but sort of becomes the master in this relationship.
What in the nature of a church organization like the LCMS makes the application of policy-based governance problematic at times?
Well, broadly speaking, first of all, Todd, the church, unlike maybe some other organizations that might use policy-based governance, wants to involve people and bring them along. And I'm not talking about a kind of a everybody sit on the floor, take your shoes off and sing kumbaya sort of sense. I'm talking about the idea of maintaining a kind of a united approach within the church organization. Policy-based governance, by putting a great deal of authority in the top executive, if you have one, can actually end up alienating people who don't like the top executive's style of management. Policy-based governance basically says, as long as he's getting the job done, and as long as he is not infringing on any of the things he's supposed to avoid infringing on, then we're content with however he does it. And in the church, we need a few more guides and fences and understandings so that people are not put off just by a personality, or for that matter, unduly attracted by a personality. Another thing, in policy-based governance, you give this authority to the chief executive, if you've got one. And what's the other side of it? You know, what's the place where there's some real teeth, some real accountability? You give this executive all this authority. If he doesn't meet up to expectations, policy-based governance basically says, well, then you change executives. You just get rid of this one and you get another one. But in a church organization, well, there are things to deal with, like divine calls or sometimes terms of office. Even a term of office means that a board that is dissatisfied with its executive may be able to get rid of him at the end of his term. But if he's, like, say, in the middle of a four-year term, let's say, and there's two more years to go, well, you can't get rid of him all that easily, and maybe not as easily as the board of a secular organization might. And so the organization and the board need to work and walk along with the executive, and having certain bylaws and resolutions in place that guide that relationship become much more important, and much more important not to do an end run around. Another example, appointing faculty at synodical educational institutions. Here, a pure application of John Carver-type policy-based governance is, I think, pretty much impossible, because in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, the president, say, of a college or a university can't just bring onto the faculty whoever he wants. There are procedures and there are various things even in the synodical bylaws that tell how you have to do this. And with respect to theology faculty, college or seminary theology faculty, there's an additional step. Prior approval has to be granted before the board can even call somebody to a position like that. So my point is, Todd, the Synod has adopted bylaws and resolutions that give a lot more direction, and understandably so, for the church than a stockholders meeting in a secular organization might ordinarily give to that organization.
Here's the big question, and you hinted at this earlier in our conversation, because policy-based governance is intended to be applied in the context of governing boards. Does the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod have governing boards as defined by policy-based governance?
I would say no. Now, I'll get an argument with some people over this. And part of the reason why I get the argument is, if you see the synodical bylaws, it even uses the term governing boards. However, what the bylaws mean by a governing board is different from what, say, John Carver meant by a governing board. John Carver said, basically, look at the organizational chart. Look at that chart, those boxes and everything. If your board is at the very top with no box above it, then you are the governing board. If, on the other hand, you have a box above you, then, at least in Carver's terms, you're not the governing board. You are what he calls a line board. Now, a line board may have authority over a particular set of things and have its responsibilities and all that kind of stuff, but it's not the kind of governing board for which he was writing. This is one of the places where I was telling you, Todd, we had misunderstandings, because I thought that a lot of, for example, the Synod's program boards who were adopting policy-based governance had just a category mistake. Even in Carver terms, they were trying to use policy-based governance on a line board, when Carver says, I'm not giving you stuff for line boards.
So I guess into the details, to whom are the national level boards of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod answerable ultimately?
Well, we have boards and we have boards because we have different kinds of agencies. All of them are, in a certain way anyway, responsible to the Synod's board of directors. less so for the boards, for example, of synod-wide corporate entities, which are separately incorporated agencies like Concordia Publishing House, Concordia Historical Institute, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Foundation, and others. And then a much more close relationship for other boards to the board of directors. But certainly everybody is responsible to the convention of the synod. That's where really the owners, the congregations of the synod, which are the voting members of the synod, send representatives and the decisions are made and the officials are elected and reports are given and people are held to account. Even contemporary policy-based governance will tell you that the board's primary relationship is with the owners of the agency, organization, whatever it is, not the staff. Now, one place where you might begin to question whether we've got synodical boards that are more governing boards and kind of independent is in the case of some of our college boards of regents. But even there, the bylaws of the synod say very explicitly, and I'm quoting here, that a board of regents shall operate and manage the institution, the college or university, as the agent of the synod. It's not free to govern that organization or that institution, rather, in any way that it wants. It does so as the agent of the synod. These boards report to the synod in convention. And by the way, I'm glad to see that they're beginning to do that again. For a while, those boards had not been actually filing separate reports to the synod, and they should, because they are synodical boards, and they're just as much accountable to the convention as any other board would be.
We're talking about policy-based governance in the church. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest, formerly an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. When we come back, we're going to talk about how the 2010 major overhaul of the structure of the LCMS affected its boards. It's time to register to vote for the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Each congregation or multi-point parish must register their pastor and lay voters with the LCMS Office of Secretary by Sunday, March 24th of 2019. A nomination form has been mailed to every LCMS congregation. Learn more at issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident. issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Greetings to you from the heart of Texas. I'm Pastor Mark Knuckles, the senior pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church and School. We are the LCMS Mother Church of Austin and are situated just blocks from the University of Texas. Liturgical in worship and confessional in teaching, we are a dual parish with the only Lutheran deaf congregation in the Austin area, Jesus Lutheran Church of the Deaf. Come see what God is doing among us through His Word and His sacraments.
How do Christians live authentically in an anti-Christian society? Do we run or hide or fight? Do we blend in or stand out? Are we all by our lonesome, or all in this together? Explore answers to these vital questions in the March issue of the Lutheran Witness, Life Together, Set Apart. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Real Reformation Radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Cupertino, California. Zion Lutheran, Muskoda, Illinois. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dubuque, Iowa. Trinity Lutheran, Paola, Kansas. St. Paul Lutheran of Good Harbor, Cedar, Michigan. Trinity Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. Redeemer Lutheran, Fort Worth, Texas. St. John Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, Warminster, Pennsylvania, Mount Calvary Lutheran, Brookings, South Dakota, and Emmanuel Lutheran, Manchester, New Hampshire. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. We're talking about policy-based governance in the church. He has a PhD in church history from Ohio State University, and he's director of evangelism, mission, stewardship, and human care for the Central Illinois District of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Ken, this is the question that was kind of rolling around in my mind when I was formulating the questions for our conversation today, because in 2010, there was a major overhaul, as you call it, of the structure of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. How did that overhaul affect the Synod's program boards?
Well, it eliminated them. We eliminated all the program boards. And you and I talked about this, Todd, 10 years ago. I was preparing for this interview, and I ran across all my old notes from interviews we did literally in the year 2009, where I was saying then, and I will say it again, it was a mistake, in my opinion, to get rid of all those program boards. I think it was a short-sighted thing. For example, the motivation, the reason given at the time was, we'll save money this way. We don't have to bring people in for a meeting. We don't have to pay to have people fly in from all over the country, et cetera, et cetera. But in the long run, I think we're going to find that this was a bad idea. Well, okay, what did we put in the place of these program boards? Things like the Board for Mission, the Board for Human Care, Board for Communication Services, Board for Congregational Services, et cetera. We have now two what we call mission boards, and they are policy boards. They make a great many policies. They monitor the implementation of those policies, but they do not actually supervise the implementation of policy, nor do they supervise the staff as the staff implements the policy. That responsibility is now given to the president of the Synod. So in a way, this is kind of odd because they're called policy boards in some of the literature, and you would think, oh, well, this fits right in with policy-based governance. Actually, it can't, because if you're trying to do pure policy-based governance, these boards don't have the kind of authority over the implementation and over the people who are doing the implementation to do policy-based governance. They couldn't do it if they tried.
To whom are individual members of various boards responsible in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod?
Yeah, this is a perennially difficult thing, and I don't know why necessarily. You know, if the board is responsible to the synod, and especially manifested as the synod in convention, then why would you think that the individual members of the board, as they are serving as members of that board, would be responsible anywhere else? Now, it's true, we do have a different configuration from one seat on a board to another in the cases of many boards about how they got there. Some of these board members are actually elected by the Synod at the national level at a synodical convention. Others are elected at the district level, but still elected by the Synod, as the district being the Synod in that place. That would seem to be a kind of an easy line of accountability to draw. Well, okay, I was elected by the Synod. I'm accountable to the Synod. I'm responsible to the Synod. Even there, it's not always so clear. It becomes particularly unclear when you have other members of certain boards who are appointed, and sometimes they are actually appointed by that very board. But instead of rushing in and saying, well, okay, then they're responsible to the people who appointed them, they're responsible to the other members of the board, still, I would point out, the Synod does have expectations. The duties that it makes incumbent upon that board and its members are incumbent upon all of the members, not just the ones that were elected by the Synod. We would have a really bad situation on our hands if within a board they conceived of one of the dynamics animating that board as a kind of a balancing of the interests of those who feel primarily responsible to one constituency and others who feel responsible to another constituency. Our boards have enough difficult problems to deal with without adding that as a complicating factor. One of the great privileges I have had over the years in my work in the church, Todd, is to have seen up close and to have discussions with some of our really fine churchmen and administrators. And one of the best I ever saw as an administrator who worked his whole career in the field of Christian education was Dr. Mike Stelmachowicz. And I remember being at my first Board for Youth Ministry meeting back in 1975 and listening to Mike, who had been chairman of that board for years. And he just said to the rest of the board in that meeting, he said, do not be selective in your implementation of synodical resolutions. Don't pick and choose which resolutions of the synod you kind of like and the ones you don't, because basically what he was telling us, that's not your job. You're responsible to the synod, which has adopted all of these resolutions. And if you don't like one of these resolutions, there are ways to deal with that, ways to petition the synod to change, but don't take it upon yourself to selectively implement the synod and what the synod has decided. That right there has implicit within it the responsibility of the board and even board members to the synod.
So what implications does that responsibility have for the way that board members conduct themselves both inside and outside board meetings? And should it affect the way that they are regarded by others in the Senate?
Well, let me make one point just abundantly clear. And I don't think, again, we needed policy-based governance to come along and tell us this. Board members do not have any authority as individuals. They are board members, but just because somebody from the board, say, calls up and says to the executive of an organization or an agency, hey, I want this done, or I want to see that done, or please do this for me, they don't have authority singly. It's the board as a whole that has this authority. And this is a big point that policy-based governance makes, and I applaud the point. It's also true, however, that a board member, while he shouldn't get too big for his britches and shouldn't pretend that, you know, he's got authority as an individual that he truly doesn't have, nonetheless, a board member is always a board member. And when these board members, you know, go to church with other people or go on vacation and visit another congregation or go to a LLL convention or a district convention and somebody flags them down and says, hey, I know you're on such and such board. Let's talk about, you know, that agency. These board members should not be inhibited from talking about the activities of that agency.
So are board members to serve, and this is going to the heart of your concerns about policy-based governance and the concerns of others, should they serve more as advocates to synod for their agency, or are they more advocates to the agency for the synod, especially its confession of faith?
Yeah, I think you're right, Todd. This really does kind of get right to the heart of things. And this is the place where, again, it's sort of hard to get this point across to people. Maybe it's because you become a board. Let's say you're the board member of some synodical college or university. You kind of wear that, rightfully so, as a badge of honor. It is an honor to have even been considered for such a position, or to have been chosen, certainly, to such a position. And you do have people who want to come up and sort of talk to you about the school and things like that. And it's very easy to sort of think of yourself now as a kind of a goodwill ambassador to those individuals and even to the entire synod for whatever is going on at that school. When in fact, if everything we've said up to this point is true, it really runs the other way around. That board is responsible primarily to the synod, and the individual members of the board are responsible also to the synod. Yeah, they need to see themselves as advocates to the agency, to the school, to whatever, for the synod that elected them, or that at least is governing their membership on the board, and especially within all that, the confession of faith for which the synod exists in the first place, to make that confession.
Often what I've heard from people about policy-based governance inside the Missouri Synod, they are given the impression as board members that the executive sets the agenda. They're supposed to talk about what the executive wants to talk about.
Well, to a degree, that is true. An executive needs to make recommendations. Board members typically are not, in any kind of scenario I'm aware of, going to be so familiar with the day-to-day workings of any agency so that they can sort of project the agenda. I'll give you an example of what I do here. I work with several of our commissions, that's what we call them here, not boards, in the Central Illinois District. And I always give them as full a report as I possibly can, but I also tell them I will not make your agenda for you. That is one of the most, in my mind, important responsibilities that a governing board or even one of our little line commissions has. To set the agenda means we're going to determine what we're going to talk about and how much time we're going to spend talking about it. Now, they need to be informed by me because I have insight into what's going on that they don't, so that they can make intelligent decisions. But finally, how they spend their time in a meeting is their determination, not mine.
We're talking about policy-based governance in the church. Dr. Ken Sherb is our guest. He formerly served as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Issues Etc. Making the Case conference begins 3 months from today in Chicago. It's our one and only 2019 conference, and it features Ross Douthat of the New York Times, Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine, LCMS President Pastor Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith of National Review, and LCMS Worship Director Will Whedon. Early bird registration is $115 and includes three meals. Attendance is limited to 500. We already have 130 registrants as of today. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org or send your check along with a downloadable registration form to Issues Etc., Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Making the Case is Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. When we come back, what if the executive wants to be the sole conduit of information?
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
The Lutheran Women's Missionary League is the Lutheran Federal Credit Union Ministry of the Month. During March, if you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to the LWML. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Oh no! Another Lutheran dirge and other myths.
Pastor Will Whedon, Director of Worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about this year's hymn sing at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
We'll be doing some myth-busting during our hymn sing. Double dare anyone to participate and walk away thinking Lutherans sing dirges. From God's Own Child to Lord Thee I Love. From Dear Christians One and All Rejoice to In Thee Is Gladness. Oh yeah, lots of joy bursting out in song all over the place. And so sorry, not a dirge in sight. Real Lutheran church music.
Join Pastor Will Whedon and Issues Etc. listeners from around the world for a hymn sing at our one and only Making the Case conference in 2019. Making the Case is Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th on the campus of Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more about the premier conference for Christian laity at issuesetc.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Thursday, March the 7th, we're talking with Dr. Ken Sherb about policy-based governance in the church. Ken, before the break, we were talking about kind of one variation on the executive saying, well, okay, I'm going to tell everyone what to talk about. I'm going to set the agenda, in essence. What if the executive claims to be the sole conduit of information back and forth from staff to board, and that path of information must run through him or her?
Well, again, there is a kind of a rationale to that. There is an importance of board members remaining board members and staff remaining staff. It's not a good idea in general for board members to be communicating directly with staff, for say board members of a synodical college or university to be in direct contact with members of the faculty about institutional business. You really do need to go through the executive, in this case, the president of the institution. At the same time, you have to recognize that in a sinful world, an executive can become a bottleneck and can give the board only what that executive wants the board to hear. One of the greatest, I think, practical ways of dealing with that was when I was teaching at Concordia Ann Arbor, our president, Jim Kirshen, at the time, just served the faculty notice that any faculty member who wanted to come in and talk to the board about any subject that that faculty member had on his mind could have access to the board. You couldn't just give carte blanche and let them talk forever. They'd have a very limited amount of time, and they'd have to kind of make their point and leave. But they could come into a board meeting knowing what the board was going to be discussing. They could make their point in 5 minutes with, I think it was, the president sitting right there, and then leave. But that way there was a sort of a check against the president simply telling the board only what he wanted the board to hear, and yet this is not in any way feeding the unpleasant and unhealthy idea of little cliques of board members and certain faculty members, say, over here against board members and certain faculty members over there. What that faculty member said was said to the entire board.
Here's the frustration I experienced while a member of a staff under a formerly existing program board in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. As a clergyman on staff, I felt the need to be able to communicate to somebody above the executive about things that weren't getting communicated to the board. I was conscience-bound to do this working for the church. I was repeatedly told that that was a violation of policy-based governance and that the executive, if he thought it was important, would communicate to the board. And that was the ongoing frustration for me as a staff member under an executive and policy-based governance there. It was not a matter of, I want to gripe about my boss. It was a matter of, there are things I need to communicate to this board as a pastor about certain things, and I simply wasn't permitted to do it.
Yeah, and again, you don't necessarily even need to have policy-based governance to have a executive who kind of serves as a bottleneck. The only thing I guess I take comfort in is that usually nothing gets bottlenecked forever. Sooner or later, things do become public that even people tried maybe to keep private.
Well, so here's another scenario, Ken. So someone approaches a board member with a concern about the agency that the board supervises. The board member tries to raise this concern at a meeting, but is called out of order because it is claimed that such concerns ought to be addressed exclusively with the board's chief executive officer. What's wrong with that picture?
In this case, you've got somebody not from the staff. You've got somebody from outside the board altogether who is, you know, raising a concern and says, hey, Fred, I know you're on such and such a board. Would you please bring this concern to that board? And I'll go back to my friend Mike Stelmachowicz, who at one of our Board for Youth Ministry meetings was listening when one of our board members, a layman from Nebraska, came with a concern. And, you know, at first, I think there was a tendency around the table to say, well, this is not that big a deal. And why is he even taking up the time? But then he said, now, my pastor asked me to bring this concern to this board. And at that, Mike sat up and he said, well, wait a second. You're telling me that your pastor, a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, asked you, a member of the Board for Youth Ministry, to bring that particular concern to this board's meeting? Yes, the guy says. Mike turns to everybody else and says, we must listen to this. How can we not? Now, that just makes such eminently good sense to me. I cannot imagine the justice or the wisdom of any kind of governance model that would say, no, you've got to direct your concerns to the board through one and only one method, that the board members should not in any way be approached with any kind of concerns about that agency. I used to say board members exist to be lobbied. I ran into one of our execs who said, I don't want anybody talking to the members of my board unless I know about it, or almost, you know, they had his permission. And that was my response at the time. Board members exist to be lobbied. Now, that doesn't mean that the board has to immediately put the brakes on and say, okay, we're dropping everything because somebody had a concern from Nebraska. You know, we're going to belay our agenda. We're not going to do anything else until we get to the bottom of this one thing. That could get you right back into the kind of micromanagement that everybody agrees is not good. So the board had alternatives at that point. It could have said, we want a particular person from the board to inquire further. We want the staff to do some more research on this. It's usually not a good idea at that point to pair board and staff members together and say, you work on this together. Board members need to be board members. Staff members need to be staff members. But the board needs to do its work, keep its agenda going without being unduly sidetracked, but at the same time, without failing to take such concerns from the people who really do finally own the Synod and its boards into account.
With only a minute here, Ken, how has the LCMS's use of policy-based governance worked out in practice?
I wish I could give you an overall report card, Todd. I don't necessarily have the best perspective on this, the best seat from which to say. From where I do sit, I'd say that it's kind of mixed. No one that I know of is using or even claiming these days to use a pure policy-based governance model anymore. There used to be people who said that they were using pure policy-based governance, but even then it probably wasn't true. Hopefully, their adaptations that have occurred have been more careful and nuanced, because some of the policy-based governance stuff just can't fly in the Missouri Synod. But that makes it hard to generalize. What I would say in closing is keep theology uppermost. Don't make efficiency the be-all and end-all. Don't make getting things done and ending in the black the main barometer of how well you're doing. Don't disrespect the calls of church workers. And don't let the governance philosophy become the tail that wags the dog.
Dr. Ken Cherub has a PhD in church history from Ohio State University. He's director of evangelism and mission, stewardship and human care for the Central Illinois District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and he formerly served as a theology professor at Concordia University, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and as an assistant to the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Ken, thanks.
Always a pleasure, Todd. Thank you.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has been working steadily in Puerto Rico since Hurricanes Irma and Maria battered that area within 2 weeks of each other back in 2017. LCMS Disaster Response announced earlier this week that it's deploying $600,000 for mercy work in Puerto Rico. You can learn more about their work at lcms.org/disaster, lcms.org/disaster. Helping the hurting amid disaster, LCMS Disaster Response, lcms.org/disaster. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the means of grace in Luther's Small Catechism with Pastor Paul McCain by way of introducing our conversation on the Small Catechism's treatment of the sacraments. And it's This Week in Pop Christianity with Pastor Chris Roseborough. We'll also play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.